About 5 months ago, somebody from this church telephoned me one day and straight out of the blue said, "We'd like you to speak at Wynnum on Australia Day on the subject, Can God Survive in Australia?" Now, that was a fairly cheeky question. I think the person who phoned me thought that he was going to floor me. Well, it just so happened that the very day before, I'd been in a bookshop and I had bought a book entitled Can God Survive in Australia? So immediately I saw where he got his smart question from, and I said, "Oh yes, yes, I'd be quite happy to speak on that subject." Well, if it hadn't been, of course, that I happened to have had that book, I might have started to shop around and think to myself, goodness me, what a subject to give somebody. Well, the book is one that's been written by a man called Bruce Wilson. He's an Anglican clergyman from Sydney. Some of you may have heard him recently. He's just been up here to the Tambourine Convention. I haven't actually heard him speak, but I have read one or two other things that he's written, and I've found that he's been quite a perceptive character. Certainly he's saying some very sensible things. Anyway, I read that book through, and I've stuck to the title, although I suppose an alternative title would be, How Do We Live in This Modern Age of Technology? So that's an alternative title, if you like. As I read the book, I certainly found a number of things in it which were very helpful, and right now I'll acknowledge my indebtedness to Bruce Wilson for a few of the ideas that I've collected. However, over the years I've thought and read quite a bit around this general area, so it's something of an accumulation, you might say, of some of my own observations and thoughts, spiced along by a few of the tips that this man gave me. I read the book as I was flying up to the Solomon Islands a few months ago, and then I read a bit more of it as I was flying back. And that really was an ideal situation in which to read it, because a lot of the emphasis, you might say, or some of the major considerations are, how do we get on in this modern society? Is Christianity still relevant? And then to go to the Solomon Islands, where I was living much of the time in a fairly primitive setup, to see the contrast was very, very enlightening, and it certainly gave me one or two more ideas in relation to this talk today. Can God survive in Australia? I guess the implication there is that God is a little bit out of date, a bit old-fashioned, not quite relevant to our modern type of society. And so what you find at times is that people try to jazz up the whole thing. They jazz up the church, or they give it an Australian flavour. And so the old ochreism rears its ugly head once more, and this time it imposes itself upon the church. So we're going to have an Australian church service. We're going to have an Australian hymn book. We're going to have Australian this and Australian that. Well, I suppose there's some merit in thinking like that, but just how far you take these things, I'm not quite sure. It's a little bit like thinking we should have an Australian car. But when we had an Australian car, I guess it was a car like any other car. And we didn't go thinking of making a car that had a couple of good saplings for axles and a bunch of gum leaves which swung backwards and forwards over your windscreen to make a windscreen wiper. That type of stupid thinking is sometimes what affects people when they come to think about how we're going to make the church Australian. Look, we can jazz up the thing, or we can ochreize the thing as much as we like, but I don't really think that is going to make very much difference. It's not the presentation that's at fault. It's not the packaging that's at fault, it's the product itself. It's not that the thing's not Australian enough, it's simply that God and religion and the Bible and all associated with it appears to people to be irrelevant. And you can doctor it up, you can fix it, you can give it an Australian flavour as much as you like, and it's not really going to make all that much difference. It's a little bit like taking an ice chest, the old-fashioned ice chest, and making it modern. You can put some computer gadget on the outside of it, you can have an electronic timepiece, you can paint it in modern colours, you can give it the modern space-age shape, you can use space-age metals in the trimmings if you wish. But the point is, it's still an ice chest, and you're not going to sell the thing, because people are now using refrigerators. And so no matter how much you change the packaging of the thing, people are still going to reject it because they reckon the product's out of date. Now that's the way it is with the church. People see the church as being out of date. We try to change the appearances on the outside, and Really, that's not the fundamental problem. Why is it then that people are finding the church out of date? Or what are these influences that are affecting our society which create this problem for us? Well, I guess there are many reasons. As you go into different places, you'll find different influences at work. But in the West at large, I should say that one of the main reasons for the present difficulty that the church faces has to do with the industrialization which came through the Industrial Revolution, or to speak in more up-to-date terms, the technology which sees everything as being under control, and we can achieve anything through the fruits of science and technology. Now let me make a contrast here between the old type of society and the new type of society. The new type of society being the one which came about through the Industrial Revolution, the old type of society being the more primitive type of society that existed previously and which still exists in some parts of the world today. Now I saw this very clearly when I was in the Solomons. In the old type of society, a person worked at home, and the fruits of his work were really the be-all and end-all of his life. That is, he consumed what he produced. He was more or less self-sufficient. Now this is what I saw in the Solomons. It happened to me twice. I should have known better the second time, but I asked the person, I was in a country village, and I asked the person what he did for a living. And he looked at me almost as if I was stupid. He looked around and he said, well, you know, can't you see? I've got my house here and there's some potatoes growing there and there's a couple of coconut trees. There's a few chickens, a couple of pigs down there. I look after all these. What do you mean? What do I do? You see, that's where he lived. That's where he worked. And in most of those villages, that's the way it was. Very few people went out somewhere and earned a living and came back. Most of them had their own plot. They grew their own vegetables. They ate what they produced and they looked after themselves. One chap said to me, really, he said, we don't need very much money. He said, we need money if we want to travel, we have to pay fares. We also need it if we have to go into a hospital or have to pay for school books and things like that. But for the majority of their living expenses, they have no real need because they simply are looking after themselves. They're growing their own food, they're producing their own requirements, they have their own animals, and most people were working there in a self-sufficient fashion. Now today, in an industrialized society, we don't live like that. It's just the opposite, really. Very few of us consume the things we produce. Most of the things we are using have been produced by someone else, and most of the things we are producing are used by someone else. We live in one place, we work in another, and there is no direct link between where we live and where we work. There is no direct link between what we do in our private lives and the way we earn our living. Now in these more primitive societies, there's no distinction, the whole thing is blurred. People don't get up in the morning and go to work and come home at night and put their feet up and read the newspaper. The whole of life, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, you might say, is more or less the one thing. Living and working and existing and moving on is all part and parcel of the one thing. But now we have got the whole issue compartmentalized. We go out to earn money. We work. For example, a person may work in an office, or he may work in a factory that produces paint tins or something like that, or he may work in a motor repair works, or he could be in a printer's shop. But the things that he is doing and the products he's producing have no direct relationship with what he's doing at home in his private hours. What he's doing is he's earning money, which then enables him to buy the other things that he needs. The things that he produces in his work are then sold to other people, but there's no direct connection between what he is doing in his work and what he's doing at home. What he does on the weekdays, 9 to 5 at work, so to speak, what he does on the weekdays, there's no connection with what he does after he gets home at night or what he does at the weekends. And so the weekends, or the time he has home after he's finished his work, this, you might say, is his own time. That's his leisure time. That's when he really does the things he wants. And the other time, that's when he works at the business of getting money, so that the money will enable him then to do the other things he wants to do in his spare time. So the need for money becomes uppermost. I'm not saying this in a derogatory sense. I'm not saying that this is the love of money is the root of all evils. I'm not having a sermon against materialism. I'm just saying this is the fact. This is the way it is in our industrialized economies. The need for money is uppermost because if you don't have it, you can't do anything. You can't buy the services you want. You can't buy the things you need. Which creates the impression that work is simply there as a means of getting money, and then the money enables me to really get the things I need for true living. Now the results of this can be twofold. Well, there can be many fold, but I just summarized it under 2 points here. One is that our personal relations suffer. We become more selfish because we're more concerned with getting what we want to get, and so the sense of community, which you find very strong in these primitive societies I'm talking about, that sense of community disappears. Personal relationships suffer, we become more self-sufficient, and with our self-sufficiency comes greater selfishness. And the second point is that there's less sense of commitment to vocation. And so we can change jobs if we think we can get a better deal somewhere else. We sell our labour or expertise to somebody else so that we can make more money for the amount of effort, time and work we're putting into something. So the sense of commitment to vocation becomes secondary. Now the same attitude tends to carry across into the church. Our sense of commitment to the church, we tend to view that in much the same way as we view our commitment to, let us say, our work. You find then that just as the weekend is the main time when we are free from work to do our own thing, this spills over into the church, and so if the commitment of the church has to suffer, well, that's just part of what life is. Even, say, 20 years ago, people who were committed to some sort of function in the church would be there week in, week out. It never went into their head not to be there to teach their Sunday school class. But that's not the way it is now. If the Sunday school class has to go by the board for a week or so, well, that's too bad for the Sunday school class. I want to go away for the weekend. There's something else I want to do. And so that sense of commitment is diminished. The independence which we achieve through work to do our own things in our leisure time spills over into the church, with the result that people feel less obliged to make their contribution. In other words, the general freedom, the affluence, the self-sufficiency, the higher standard of living, the better sense of well-being that we achieve through the progress of our technology, through the increased cash that we get from our work, this inevitably is going to have some effect upon our relationship to the church. So if I can just summarize the whole of this area that I've been talking about, the general process is something like this. That industrialization inevitably leads to greater consumerism. The consumerism in turn produces greater individualism. This individualism inevitably produces a certain degree of selfishness. And the end run of that selfishness is that God tends to be squeezed out. Now I believe that Christians can still live in an industrialized society. They can still participate in this cycle that we're talking about, because there's not much way they've got of getting out of it, unless of course they opt for some alternative lifestyle and go and live out in the country somewhere by themselves. But in the normal run of events, most of us are here in the cities or wherever we happen to be in ordinary type of society. But we can show that true living can be achieved within the context of this total scene that we live in. And this compartmentalization that we've talked about, this separation of things into different boxes, this tendency to squeeze God out, I believe that can be reversed. Let me develop this now as we talk about the fruits of technology and how these things have affected our society, and specifically how they've affected our understanding of God and our relationships to God. Now I've just summarized this under 6 points. The first point I've got here is that because of the achievements of technology, we tend to think that nothing is beyond us. Well, we can do almost anything. When you think of the achievements, it certainly does seem that way. Almost anything man wants to do, he can do. And the impression that comes to us as a result of this is that there are no forces outside man's grasp. If there is a desert, he can turn it into fertile country. He can dam rivers. He can supply water where previously there was none. He has reversed the night. In primitive societies, if you live in any of these places where technology has not penetrated, such as I was mentioning in those remote villages of the Solomons where there's no electricity, you'll find that the whole way of life is different. You get up early with the sun, you go to bed early. Whereas with us, after the sun has gone down, we keep doing things for hours and hours and hours. In fact, we can do almost the same things at night as we do in the day because of electricity. You see, again, man can even reverse the natural things of the creation. The darkness, he can turn it into light. You see what I mean? The impression is created that man can do anything, so that the feeling of awe that people once had for God tends to be lessened and lessened and lessened, and he's not quite as clever as they once thought he was. So that's the first point. The second point, there is less room for God. Well, that arises out of the first, doesn't it? God gradually gets squeezed out. And because God is getting squeezed out, the church is getting squeezed out. It's starting to look now as if the church has been linked to something out of date and old-fashioned. 50 years ago, we might have thought God could do this and God can do that, but now look what man can do. Something can happen in Britain, and at the very instant, you can see it on your TV screen here in Australia. And so these magical, if you like, things are happening all the time. The sense of wonder has diminished, and it appears that if man can do everything, where do you fit in God? It seems that there's nothing that God can do that man can't do. Slowly but surely, God is squeezed out. Yet at the same time, there seems to be a greater emphasis upon the occult and upon magic than there's ever been in our society. Partly because within the heart of man there is some sense of God. Man instinctively knows that there is a God. But when God is squeezed out because of technology, all the clever things they thought God can do, now they find man can do them as well. At the same time, they don't entirely forget God. There is that dimension to life which only God can satisfy. Man was made in the image of God. There is something unlimited within him. And because he's forgotten God, or because he's dismissed God as being a bit old-fashioned and 19th century, he finds there's a void. And so you find now there's this great upsurge of interest in the occult. So that is my second point. The third point flows on from that. There's less interest also in morals. We have now a great emphasis on what I call in cold blood type reporting. They report the thing in cold blood. This is the way it is. And people seem to take great pride in shocking you by showing you exactly that's the way it is. And the tendency is to believe, well, that's it. I mean, science has told us, technology is presented, there it is on the screen, and we've seen it. The spirit of the age is one of technology and science, with this great emphasis on facts, and we are shown how things work. But science and technology can only tell us what is. They can't tell us what ought to be. And that's the great difference. You see, we can have a discussion on, let us say, so it's a medical program, something to do with medical science. What is the best way to take out a person's appendix? Now, largely, that's going to be an issue that's discussed on the basis of technology, scientific investigation, our knowledge of the subject. And then in the very same atmosphere, they discuss how can we deal with homosexuality. Now, how to deal with a person who's got appendicitis and how to deal with a person who's afflicted with homosexual practices are not in the same category. Yet the way things are presented, you think they were. Science is concerned with what is. It's not concerned with what ought to be. And so the emphasis on technology has sucked people in, and unwittingly they are thinking that because they see the facts, all the anatomical considerations, all the data put before them, they think that's the sole answer. But the moral considerations, science can't deal with those. But unconsciously we are led into a position where we've forgotten that. People as a whole, I'm speaking of here, as a whole, society's forgotten that. Because technology has said we have all the answers. We can do anything. And so the interest in moral considerations correspondingly diminishes. Which leads me to my fourth point. there's a greater compartmentalization. Things are seen more as specialists' work. We know that years ago you could go to the local GP and he'd fix up nearly anything. But now we have specialists in just about every part of the anatomy that you can think of. So that the GP is shunting us off to specialists for this, that and the other. Likewise, our motor car. Once upon a time you could take the motor car to a mechanic and he could do anything. But now there are specializations. There's all sorts of technology and machinery and equipment, electronic gadgetry that can look into all the different parts of a motor car so that people are specializing in different areas. I have a friend who's in the computer game, he's a computer engineer, but he said things have got to the stage now where nobody can keep track of everything because the flood of knowledge is just so great, nobody can keep up with it, and so people have to specialize in certain areas. This again spills over into our attitudes towards God and the church. Things are seen as specialist work. So when there are problems in the family or in the marriage, instead of seeking help from a pastor or an elder, the tendency is to seek help from a marriage counsellor or a social worker. Now, I'm not against marriage counsellors and social workers. No doubt they can make a contribution. But again, the tendency is there to say we can answer everything in terms of the research we have done with our updated insights and technology. But things are always going to look different from the point of view of God. Man is more than simply a collection of chemicals. He's more than simply a functioning machine. There are these spiritual considerations, and almost every topic is going to look different when we look at it from the perspective of eternity, from the perspective of God. Because we have been conned into believing that all the problems can be answered as a result of our modern research, we then have this impression that religion is pushed out of the way. Oh, the pastor, he's into a prayer. I mean, if you've got a problem about prayer or something like that, well, you can go and see him, but that's his specialty. But if it's a problem of marriage relationships, well, don't go and see him because he doesn't really understand those sorts of things. You have to hop off and see some marriage counselling service. This specialisation has tended once again to lock the church off as if religion is a separate part of one's life, just as sex is another part of one's life, entertainment and leisure, that's another part of one's life, and so it goes on. My fifth point is that because of our greater exposure to the world out there through TV, through more international travel and the like, it appears to people that Christianity is but one of many options. Previously, we've been brought up to think that Christianity is the true religion, and then you have all these other false religions scattered around the world. But people travel more. They watch TV and they're exposed to a much wider world. Keith Adams takes them to the Himalayas or to some other exotic kingdom of the East. They see weird religions. So people start to think that all this Christianity thing is not really the truth. We've only been conditioned by our upbringing into believing what we're taught concerning Christianity in the Bible. But there's all these other religions, Japanese, people in Africa, people in China, in India, or wherever you happen to be, and they've got all these other different religions. And so people's faith in the validity of Christianity is shaken, and without stopping to think the thing through, they just drift with the tide into this impression that Christianity is simply the particular religion that the West got hooked on, just as Hinduism was the religion that the Indians got hooked on. And so again, God tends to be a little bit smaller than he used to be and a bit less relevant to living. And the sixth point that I've got down here is that because of this swamping of us by technology, people tend to accept anything that's done in the name of science. Now, you just notice the TV advertisements, the number of them that will spill out a few bits of scientific data. And it's amazing how people are convinced. The number of times I've spoken to people concerning different products myself, but this has been scientifically proved to have something, something in it, and this extra additive in the toothpaste is going to do wonders against tooth decay or whatever it happens to be. As long as there's some appearance that scientific investigation has come up with this answer, it tends to carry a lot of weight with people. Now, this again spills over, and you can find that even the talking about sex, for example, a lot of programs on the TV that touch on aspects of sex, but the whole thing again has become mechanical, as if it's just a matter of considering physical aspects, the anatomy of the whole thing, how it works, almost as if it's a sort of mechanical copulation type of machine here they're looking at. That's all that's put to people for their consideration. I guess in sex education, in schools, again, the emphasis is on the how to do it, how not to do it, what are the physiological implications. The moral values, the fact that we have a total commitment of one person to another, and a sexual relationship is only part of a wider relationship where each commits himself, herself to the other in a relationship which is binding and lasting, those aspects are not touched upon, because we've been conned into thinking that the physiological, the mechanical, the scientific side of things is the most important. And once people are drifting into that attitude, the spiritual values automatically are going to decline, and sometimes they'll just disappear. This is the type of age we live in, and these are some of the problems we have to grapple with. And how are we going to live with technology? One of the first things you've got to realize is that science can't prove everything. Now, I don't have to elaborate upon this much because I've mentioned it half a dozen times already. Science can't prove God. You can't put God in a test tube and see what he's like. Science can't prove, for example, whether you have hope, whether you have love, whether you have bitterness. You can open a person's brain and find out a few things about it, but you're not going to find love buried inside there. You're not going to find hatred buried inside there. You're not going to find if a person is full of hope or if he's pessimistic. You can't prove these sorts of things by technology. God is a person who is invisible. The spiritual aspect of man is not material. The very fact that it's spiritual means that it's not material. So if it's not material, it can't be reduced to the types of formulae that science and technology would want to reduce things to. Yet, as we've seen, the idea of God is basic to human nature. We can't get away from it. It's there. In spite of all these technological advances, the idea of God is still there within the conscience and the heart, within the mind of man. Now, that's why I had read to you in the section earlier in our service, that portion from Acts chapter 17, where Paul was speaking to the people in Athens. Now, these were non-Christian people. And among the things that he says is, people seek God in the hope that as they feel after him, they might find him. Now, he was talking about various other aspects of false religion that he'd seen in the city, a temple to the unknown God and all that sort of thing. And he says that this God made the heavens and the earth, and all these philosophers sitting around there in the circle and discussing things, the very fact, he said, that they were discussing these issues, the very fact that there was this temple to the unknown God, these facts, he says, indicate that within man there is something which seeks out beyond that which is seen, beyond the things which can be proved by science or technology. They're seeking after God, and perhaps they might find him. This spiritual aspect of man, what is real living, what really determines whether a person finds life in its fullest meaning or not, these matters are not decided by technology. Technology does not answer all the questions. If technological achievement decided human happiness, then you'd expect that the cleverest people would be the happiest people. But they're not. If technological achievement really decided how there would be more kindness and love in society, then once again you would expect that the cleverest people would be the kindest people and the most loving people. But we know that's not true. You'd expect that as technology advances, that society would become more kind, more compassionate, more loving, that murder and violence, dishonesty, corruption, greed, selfishness, that those things would disappear. We know they don't disappear. In fact, it very often seems that they get greater. The real issues of life are not decided by such things. It is not man's abilities which decide such things. Let us get that clear. It is not man's abilities, it's man's will. And that's why it is in this section, towards the end of it, Paul said God now commands all men everywhere to repent. The real issues of life depend on the response that we make to God. Whether we find the fulfillment in life that God desires for us is going to depend not upon our abilities, but upon whether our wills have submitted to God who made us, in whose image we exist, and found in him the Lord of our life and the one who can give true meaning and direction to life. We can know lots of things. We can reason around things. But none of those matters are going to lead us to the life which is life indeed. That life is going to be realized only as we come and submit to our Creator, our Lord, and our Maker. The basic issue is not knowledge. The basic issue is repentance and faith. Submitting to God and trusting in his forgiving love and committing ourselves to him in total faith that we are going to find our life and our salvation in him. Let me read to you again those words. Being God's offspring, we ought not to think that deity is like gold or a computer or any other machine or piece of electronic equipment that man can make. He is not like anything out of gold, silver, or stone, any representation by art or technology or the imagination of man. Now, in times past, he says God overlooked the ignorance. In the pre-Christian times, but things are different now. He says God has revealed himself more fully and clearly in the person of Jesus Christ, and now he commands all men everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed, that's Jesus Christ, and of this he has given assurance to all men, because he has raised Jesus Christ from the dead. Christ is living, and the fact that he has been raised from the dead and that he is living, that is the guarantee that he will one day judge the world in righteousness. Can God survive in Australia? Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. God will survive, okay, don't bother about that. The question is, will we survive? And the answer to that question is going to depend upon the response which we make to God.